Side 6.
Once during a vigorous discussion on the relative merits of the two political systems, Ellie had boasted that she had been free to march in front of the White House protesting American involvement in the Vietnam War. Vega replied that in the same period, he had been equally free to march in front of the Kremlin protesting American involvement in the Vietnam War. He had never been inclined, say, to photograph the garbage scows burdened with malodorous refuse and squawking seagulls lumbering in front of the Statue of Liberty, as another Soviet scientist had, when for fun she had escorted him on the Staten Island ferry during a break in a meeting in New York City. Nor had he, as had some of his colleagues, ardently photographed the tumble-down shanties and corrugated metal huts of the Puerto Rican poor during a bus excursion from a luxurious beachfront hotel to the Arecibo Observatory. To whom did they submit these pictures, Ellie wondered. She conjured up some vast KGB library dedicated to the infelicities, injustices, and contradictions of capitalist society. Did it warm them, when disconsolate with some of the failures of Soviet society, to browse through the fading snapshots of their imperfect American cousins? There were many brilliant scientists in the Soviet Union who, for unknown offenses, had not been permitted out of Eastern Europe in decades. Konstantinov, for example, had never been to the West until the mid-1960s. When, at an international meeting in Warsaw, over a table encumbered with dozens of depleted Azerbaijani brandy snifters, their missions completed, Konstantinov was asked why. He replied, "Because the bastards know they let me out. I never come back." Nevertheless, they had let him out, sure enough, during the thaw in scientific relations between the two countries in the late 60s and early 70s, and he had come back every time. But now they let him out no more, and he was reduced to sending his Western colleagues New Year's cards, in which he portrayed himself forlornly cross-legged, head bowed, seated on a sphere, below which was the Schwarzschild equation for the radius of a black hole. He was in a deep potential well, he would tell visitors to Moscow in the metaphors of physics. They would never let him out again. In response to questions, Vega would say that the official Soviet position was that the Hungarian Revolution of 1956 had been organized by crypto-fascists, and that the Prague Spring of 1968 was brought about by an unrepresentative, anti-socialist group in the leadership. But, he would add, if what he had been told was mistaken, if these were genuine popular uprisings, then his country had been wrong in suppressing them. On Afghanistan, he did not even bother quoting the official justifications. Once in his office at the Institute, he had insisted on showing Ellie his personal shortwave radio, on which were frequencies labeled London and Paris and Washington, neatly spelled out in Cyrillic letters. He was free, he told her, to listen to the propaganda of all nations. There had been a time when many of his fellows had surrendered to national rhetoric about the yellow peril. "Imagine the entire frontier between China and the Soviet Union occupied by Chinese soldiers shoulder to shoulder, an invading army," one of them requested, challenging Ellie's powers of imagination. They were standing around the samovar in the director's office at the Institute. "How long would it be, with the present Chinese birth rate, before they all passed over the border?" And the answer was pronounced, in an unlikely mix of dark foreboding and arithmetic delight, "Never." William Randolph Hearst would have felt at home, but not Lunacharsky. Stationing so many Chinese soldiers on the frontier would automatically reduce the birth rate, he argued. Their calculations were therefore in error. He had phrased it as though the misuse of mathematical models was the subject of his disapproval, but few mistook his meaning. In the worst of the Sino-Soviet tensions, he had never, so far as Ellie knew, allowed himself to be swept up in the endemic paranoia and racism. Ellie loved the samovars. and could understand the Russian affection for them. Their Lunokhod, the successful unmanned lunar rover that looked like a bathtub on wire wheels, seemed to her to have a little samovar technology somewhere in its ancestry. Vega had once taken her to see a model of Lunokhod in a sprawling exhibition park outside of Moscow on a splendid June morning. There, next to a building displaying the wares and charms of the Tadsik Autonomous Republic, was a great hall filled to the rafters with full-scale models of Soviet civilian space vehicles. Sputnik 1, the first orbital spacecraft. Sputnik 2, the first spacecraft to carry an animal, the dog, Laika, who died in space. Luna 2, the first spacecraft to reach another celestial body. Luna 3, the first spacecraft to photograph the far side of the moon. Venera 7, the first spacecraft to land safely on another planet. And Vostok 1, the first manned spacecraft that carried hero of the Soviet Union, cosmonaut Yuri A. Gagarin, on a single orbit of the Earth. Outside, children were using the fins of the Vostok launch booster as slides, their pretty blonde curls and red Komsomol neckerchiefs flaring as, to much hilarity, they descended to land. Zemlya, it was called in Russian. The large Soviet island in the Arctic Sea was called Novaya Zemlya, New Land. It was there in 1961 that they had detonated a 58-megaton thermonuclear weapon, the largest single explosion so far contrived by the human species. But on that spring day, with the vendors hawking the ice cream in which Moscovites take so much pride, with families on outings, and a toothless old man smiling at Ellie and Lunacharsky as if they were lovers, the old land had seemed nice enough. In her infrequent visits to Moscow or Leningrad, Vega would often arrange the evenings. A group of six or eight of them would go to the Bolshoi or the Kirov Ballet. Lunacharsky somehow would arrange for the tickets. She would thank her hosts for the evening, and they, explaining that it was only in the company of foreign visitors that they themselves were able to attend such performances, would thank her. Vega would only smile. He never brought his wife, and Ellie had never met her. She was, he said, a physician, who was devoted to her patients. Ellie had asked him what his greatest regret was, because his parents had not, as they had once contemplated, emigrated to America.
"I have only one regret," he had said in his gravelly voice. "My daughter married a Bulgarian."
Once he arranged a dinner at a Caucasian restaurant in Moscow. A professional toastmaster, or tomada, named Kaletsi, had been engaged for the evening. The man was a master of this art form, but Ellie's Russian was bad enough that she was obliged to ask for most of the toasts to be translated. He turned to her, and foreshadowing the rest of the evening, remarked,
"We call the man who drinks without a toast an alcoholic."
An early and comparatively mediocre toast had ended to peace on all planets. And Vega had explained to her that the word Mir meant world, peace, and a self-governing community of peasant households that went back to ancient times. They had talked about whether the world had been more peaceful when its largest political units had been no larger than villages.
"Every village is a planet,"
Lunacharsky had said, his tumbler held high. "And every planet, a village," she had returned. Such gatherings would be a little raucous. Enormous quantities of brandy and vodka would be drunk, but no one ever seemed seriously inebriated. They would emerge noisily from the restaurant at 1 or 2 in the morning, and try, often vainly, to find a taxicab. Several times he had escorted her on foot, a distance of 5 or 6 kilometers from the restaurant back to her hotel. He was attentive, a little avuncular, tolerant in his political judgments, fierce in his scientific pronouncements. Although his sexual escapades were legendary among his colleagues, he never permitted himself so much as a goodnight kiss with Ellie. This had always distressed her a little, although his affection for her was plain. There were many women in the Soviet scientific community, proportionally more so than in the United States. But they tended to occupy menial to middle-level positions, and male Soviet scientists, like their American counterparts, were puzzled about a pretty woman with evident scientific competence who forcefully expressed her views. Some would interrupt her or pretend not to hear her. Then Lunacharsky would always lean over and ask in a louder voice than usual,
"What did you say, Dr. Arroway? I didn't quite manage to hear."
The others would then fall silent. And she would continue about doped gallium arsenide detectors or the ethanol content of the galactic cloud, W3. The quantity of 200-proof alcohol in this single interstellar cloud was more than enough to maintain the present population of the Earth, if every adult were a dedicated alcoholic, for the age of the solar system. The Tamada had appreciated the remark. In their subsequent toasts, they had speculated on whether other forms of life would be intoxicated by ethanol, whether public drunkenness was a galaxy-wide problem, and whether a toastmaster on any other world could be as skillful as our Trofim Sergeyevich Galatsi. They arrived at the Albuquerque airport to discover that, miraculously, the commercial flight from New York with the Soviet delegation aboard had landed a half hour early. Ellie found Vege at an airport souvenir shop, negotiating the price of some trinket. He must have seen her out of the corner of his eye. Without turning to face her, he lifted a finger.
One second, 1995?
He continued, addressing the elaborately disinterested sales clerk.
I saw the identical set in New York yesterday for $17.50.
She edged closer and observed Vege spreading a set of holographic playing cards, displaying nudes of both sexes in poses now considered merely indecorous that would have scandalized the previous generation. The clerk was making half-hearted attempts to gather the cards up, as Lunacharsky made vigorous and successful efforts to cover the counter with the cards. Vege was winning.
"I'm sorry, sir, I don't set prices, I only work here," complained the clerk. "You see the deficiencies of a planned economy,"
Vege said to Ellie, while proffering a $20 bill to the clerk.
"In a true free enterprise system, I probably could purchase this for $15. Maybe $12.95. Ah, don't look at me in that way, Ellie. This is not for me. With the Joker, there are 54 cards here. Each of them will make a nice gift for some worker at my institute."
She smiled and took his arm. "It's good to see you again, Vege."
"A rare pleasure, my dear."
On the drive to Socorro, by mutual but unspoken agreement, they mainly talked pleasantries. Valerian and the driver, one of the new security people, were in the front seats. Peter, not a voluble man even in ordinary circumstances, was content to lean back and listen to their conversation, which touched only tangentially on the issue the Soviets had come to discuss, the third level of the palimpsest, the elaborate, complex, and still undecoded message they were collectively receiving. The U.S. government had more or less reluctantly concluded that Soviet participation was essential. This was true especially because the signal from Vega was so intense that even modest radio telescopes could detect it. Years before, the Soviets had prudently deployed a number of small telescopes across the entire Eurasian landmass, stretching 9,000 kilometers over the surface of the Earth, and recently had completed a major radio observatory near Samarkand. In addition, Soviet ocean-going satellite tracking vessels were patrolling both the Atlantic and the Pacific. Some of the Soviet data were redundant, because observatories in Japan, China, India, and Iraq were recording those signals as well. Indeed, every substantial radio telescope in the world that had Vega in its sky was listening. Astronomers in Britain, France, the Netherlands, Sweden, Germany, and Czechoslovakia, in Canada and Venezuela and Australia, were recording small pieces of the message, following Vega from starrise to starset. In some observatories, The detection equipment was not sensitive enough even to make out the individual pulses. They listened anyway to an audio blur. Each of these nations had a piece of the jigsaw puzzle. Because, as Ellie had reminded Kitz, the Earth turns. Every nation tried to make some sense out of the pulses. But it was difficult. No one could tell even if the message was written in symbols or in pictures. It was perfectly conceivable that they would not decrypt the message until it cycled back to page one, if it ever did, and began again with the introduction, the primer, the decoding key. Maybe it was a very long message, Ellie thought, as Vege idly compared Taiga with Scrub Desert. Maybe it wouldn't cycle back for 100 years. Or maybe there was no primer. Maybe the message, all over the planet, the word was beginning to be capitalized, was an intelligence test. So those worlds, too stupid to decrypt it, would be unable to misuse its contents. It suddenly struck her what a humiliation she would feel for the human species if, in the end, they failed to understand the message. The moment the Americans and the Soviets decided to collaborate, and the memorandum of agreement was solemnly signed, every other nation with a radio telescope had agreed to cooperate. There was a kind of world message consortium, and people were actually talking in those terms. They needed one another's data and brain power if the message was to be decrypted. The newspapers were full of little else. The pitiful few facts that were known, the prime numbers, the Olympic broadcast, the existence of a complex message, were endlessly reviewed. It was hard to find anyone on the planet who had not, in one way or another, heard about the message from Vega. Religious sects, established and marginal, and some newly invented for the purpose, were dissecting the theological implications of the message. Some thought it was from God, and some from the devil. Astonishingly, some were even unsure. There was a nasty resurgence of interest in Hitler and the Nazi regime, and Vege mentioned to her that he had found a total of 8 swastikas in the advertisements in that Sunday's New York Times book review. Ellie replied that 8 was about par. But she knew she was exaggerating. Some weeks there were only 2 or 3. A group that called themselves Space Aryans offered definitive evidence that flying saucers had been invented in Hitler Germany. A new, unmongrelized race of Nazis had grown up on Vega and was now ready to put things right on Earth. There were those who considered listening to the signal an abomination and who urged the observatories to stop. There were those who considered it a token of advent and urged the construction of still larger radio telescopes, some of them in space. Some cautioned against working with the Soviet data on grounds that they might be falsified or fraudulent, although in the longitudes of overlap they agreed well with the Iraqi, Indian, Chinese, and Japanese data. And there were those who sensed a change in the world political climate and contended that the very existence of the message, even if it was never decrypted, was exercising a steadying influence on the quarrelsome nation-states. Since the transmitting civilization was clearly more advanced than ours, and because it clearly, at least as of 26 years ago, had not destroyed itself, it followed, some argued, that technological civilizations did not inevitably self-destruct. In a world gingerly experimenting with major divestitures of nuclear weapons and their delivery systems, the message was taken by whole populations as a reason for hope. Many considered the message the best news in a long time. For decades, young people had tried not to think too carefully about tomorrow. Now, there might be a benign future after all. Those with predispositions favoring such cheerful prognoses sometimes found themselves edging uncomfortably toward ground that had been occupied for a decade by the Kiliastic movement. Some Kiliasts held that the imminent arrival of the third millennium would be accompanied by the return of Jesus or Buddha or Krishna or the Prophet, who would establish on Earth a benevolent theocracy, severe in its judgment of mortals. Perhaps this would presage the mass celestial ascent of the elect. But there were other Kiliasts, and there were far more of these, who held that the physical destruction of the world was the indispensable prerequisite for the advent, as had been unerringly foretold in various, otherwise mutually contradictory ancient prophetic works. The doomsday Kiliasts were uneasy with the whiff of world community in the air, and troubled by the steady annual decline in the global stockpiles of strategic weapons. The most readily available means for fulfilling the central tenet of their faith was being disassembled day by day. Other candidate catastrophes, overpopulation, industrial pollution, earthquakes, volcanic explosions, greenhouse warming, ice ages, or cometary impact with the Earth, were too slow, too improbable, or insufficiently apocalyptic for the purpose. Some Kiliast leaders had assured mass rallies of devoted followers that, except for accidents, life insurance was a sign of wayward faith, that except for the very elderly, to purchase a gravesite or make funeral arrangements and other than urgent necessity was a flagrant impiety. All who believed would be raised bodily to heaven and would stand before the throne of God in only a few years. Ellie knew that Lunacharsky's famous relative had been that rarest of beings, a Bolshevik revolutionary with a scholarly interest in the world's religions. But the attention Vege directed to the growing worldwide theological ferment was apparently muted. "The main religious question in my country," he said, "will be whether the Vegans have properly denounced Leon Trotsky." As they approached the Argus site, the roadside became dense with parked automobiles, recreation vehicles, campers, tents, and great crowds of people. At night, the once tranquil plains of San Agustin were illuminated by campfires. The people along the highway were by no means all well-to-do. She noticed two young couples. The men were in t-shirts and worn jeans, belted around their hips, swaggering a little as they had been taught by their seniors upon entering high school, talking animatedly. One of them pushed a ragged stroller, in which sat a carefree boy about 2 years old. The women followed behind their husbands, one of them holding the hand of a toddler new to the human art of walking, and the other cantilevered forward with what in another month or two would be a further life born on this obscure planet. There were mystics from sequestered communities outside Taos who used psilocybin as a sacrament, and nuns from a convent near Albuquerque who used ethanol for the same purpose. There were leather-skinned, crinkly-eyed men who had spent their whole lives under the open sky, and bookish, sallow-faced students from the University of Arizona in Tucson. There were silk cravats and burnished silver string ties sold by Navajo entrepreneurs at exorbitant prices. A small reversal of the historical commercial relations between whites and Native Americans. Chewing tobacco and bubble gum were being vigorously deployed by enlisted men on leave from Davis Monthan Air Force Base. An elegantly attired, white-haired man in a $900 suit with a color-coordinated Stetson was just possibly a rancher. There were people who lived in barracks and skyscrapers, adobe hovels, dormitories, trailer parks. Some came because they had nothing better to do. Some because they wanted to tell their grandchildren that they had been there. Some arrived hoping for failure. Others were confident of witnessing a miracle. Sounds of quiet devotion, raucous hilarity, mystic ecstasy, and subdued expectation rose from the crowd into the brilliant afternoon sunlight. A few heads glanced incuriously at the passing caravan of automobiles, each marked U.S. Government Interagency Motor Pool. Some people were lunching on the tailgates of hatchbacks. Others were sampling the wares of vendors whose wheeled emporia were boldly lettered Snackmobile or Space Souvenirs. There were long lines in front of small, sturdy structures with maximum occupancy of one person that the project had thoughtfully provided. Children scampered among the vehicles, sleeping bags, blankets, and portable picnic tables, almost never chided by the adults, except when they came too close to the highway or to the fence nearest Telescope 61, where a group of shaven-headed, kowtowed, saffron-robed young adults were solemnly intoning the sacred syllable, Om. There were posters with imagined representations of extraterrestrial beings, some made popular by comic books or motion pictures. One read, "There are aliens among us." A man with golden earrings was shaving, using the side view mirror of someone's pickup truck, and a black-haired woman in a serape raised a cup of coffee in salute as the convoy sped by. As they drove toward the new main gate, near Telescope 101, Ellie could see a young man on a jerry-built platform importuning a sizable crowd. He was wearing a T-shirt that depicted the Earth being struck by a bolt of celestial lightning. Several others in the crowd, she noticed, were wearing the same enigmatic adornment. At Ellie's urging, once through the gate, they pulled off the side of the road, rolled down the window, and listened. The speaker was turned away from them, and they could see the faces in the crowd. "These people are deeply moved," Ellie thought to herself. He was in mid-oration.
"And others say there's been a pact with the devil, that the scientists have sold their souls. There are precious stones in every one of these telescopes." He waved his hand toward Telescope 101. "Even the scientists admit that. Some people say it's the devil's part of the bargain." "Ah, religious hooliganism," Lunacharsky muttered darkly, his eyes yearning for the open road before them.
"No, no, let's stay," she said. A half-smile of wonderment was playing on her lips.
"There are some people, religious people, God-fearing people, who believe this message comes from beings in space, entities, hostile creatures, aliens who want to harm us, enemies of man."
He fairly shouted this last phrase, and then paused for effect.
"But all of you are wearied and disgusted by the corruption, the decay in this society, a decay brought on by unthinking, unbridled, ungodly technology. I don't know which of you is right. I can't tell you what the message means or who it's from. I have my suspicions. We'll know soon enough. But I do know the scientists and the politicians and the bureaucrats are holding out on us. They haven't told us all they know. They're deceiving us like they always do. For too long, oh God, we have swallowed the lies they feed us, the corruption they bring."
To Ellie's astonishment, a deep rumbling chorus of assent rose from the crowd. He had tapped some well of resentment she had only vaguely apprehended.
"These scientists don't believe we're the children of God. They think we're the offspring of apes. There are known communists among them. Do you want people like that to decide the fate of the world?"
The crowd responded with a thunderous no.
"Do you want a pack of unbelievers to do the talking to God?" "No!"
they roared again.
"Or the devil? They are bargaining away our future with monsters from an alien world. My brothers and sisters, there is an evil in this place."
Elliot thought the orator was unaware of their presence. But now he half turned and pointed through the cyclone fence directly at the idling convoy.
"They don't speak for us. They don't represent us. They have no right to parley in our name."
Some of the crowd nearest the fence began jostling and rhythmically pushing. Both Valerian and the driver became alarmed. The engines had been left running, and in a moment they accelerated from the gate toward the Argus administration building, still many miles distant across the scrub desert. As they pulled away over the sound of squealing tires and the murmur of the crowd, Ellie could hear the orator, his voice ringing clearly.
"The evil in this place will be stopped. I swear it."
Chapter 8. Random Access. The theologian may indulge the pleasing task of describing religion as she descended from heaven, arrayed in her native purity. A more melancholy duty is imposed on the historian. he must discover the inevitable mixture of error and corruption which she contracted in a long residence upon Earth, among a weak and degenerate race of beings. Edward Gibbon, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, 15. Ellie ignored random access and advanced sequentially through the television stations. Lifestyles of the Mass Murderers and You Bet Your Ass were on adjacent channels. It was clear at a glance that the promise of the medium remained unfulfilled. There was a spirited basketball game between the Johnson City Wildcats and the Union Endicott Tigers. The young men and women players were giving their all. On the next channel was an exhortation in Parsi on proper versus improper observances of Ramadan. Beyond was one of the locked channels. This one apparently devoted to universally abhorrent sexual practices. She next came upon one of the premier computer channels, dedicated to fantasy role-playing games and now fallen on hard times. Accessed to your home computer, it offered a single entry into a new adventure, today's apparently called Galactic Gilgamesh, in hopes that she would find it sufficiently attractive to order the corresponding floppy disk on one of the vending channels. Proper electronic precautions were taken, so you could not record the program during your single play. Most of these video games, she thought, were desperately flawed attempts to prepare adolescents for an unknown future. Her eye was caught by an earnest anchorman from one of the old networks, discussing with unmistakable concern what was described as an unprovoked attack by North Vietnamese torpedo boats on two destroyers of the U.S. 7th Fleet in the Gulf of Tonkin, and the request by the President of the United States that he be authorized to take all necessary measures in response. The program was one of her few favorites. Yesterday's News, reruns of network news shows of earlier years. The second half of the program consisted of a point-by-point dissection of the misinformation in the first half, and the obdurate credulity of the news organizations before any claims by any administration, no matter how unsupported and self-serving. It was one of several television series produced by an organization called Really TV, including Promises, Promises, devoted to follow-up analyses of unfulfilled campaign pledges at local, state, and national levels, and Bamboozles and Baloney, a weekly debunking of what were said to be widespread prejudices, propaganda, and myths. The date at the bottom of the screen was August 5, 1964, and a wave of recollection, nostalgia was not the appropriate word, about her days in high school washed over her. She pressed on. Cycling through the channels, she rushed past an Oriental cooking series devoted this week to the hibachi, an extended advertisement for the first generation of general-purpose household robots by Haddon Cybernetics, the Soviet Embassy's Russian language news and comment program, several children's and news frequencies, the mathematics station displaying the dazzling computer graphics of the new Cornell Analytic Geometry course, the local apartments and real estate channel, and a tight cluster of execrable daytime serials until she came upon the religious networks, where, with sustained and general excitement, the message was being discussed. Attendance in churches had soared all over America. The message, Ellie believed, was a kind of mirror in which each person sees his or her own beliefs challenged or confirmed. It was considered a blanket vindication of mutually exclusive apocalyptic and eschatological doctrines. In Peru, Algeria, Mexico, Zimbabwe, Ecuador, and among the Hopi, serious public debates took place on whether their progenitor civilizations had come from space. Supporting opinions were attacked as colonialist. Catholics debated the extraterrestrial state of grace. Protestants discussed possible earlier missions of Jesus to nearby planets, and of course a return to Earth. Muslims were concerned that the message might contravene the commandment against graven images. In Kuwait, a man announced himself as the hidden imam of the Shiites. Messianic fervor had arisen among the Sosafer Hasids. In other congregations of Orthodox Jews, there was a sudden renewal of interest in Astruc, a zealot fearful that knowledge would undermine faith, who in 1305 had induced the rabbi of Barcelona, the leading Jewish cleric of the time, to forbid the study of science or philosophy by those under 25, on pain of excommunication. Similar currents were increasingly discernible in Islam. A Thessalonian philosopher, auspiciously named Nicholas Polydemos, was attracting attention with a set of passionate arguments for what he called the reunification of the religions, governments, and peoples of the world. Critics began by questioning the re. UFO groups had organized round-the-clock vigils at Brooks Air Force Base near San Antonio, where the perfectly preserved bodies of four occupants of a flying saucer that had crash-landed in 1947 were said to be languishing in freezers. The extraterrestrials were reputed to be 1 meter tall and to have tiny, flawless teeth. Apparitions of Vishnu had been reported in India, and of the Amida Buddha in Japan. Miraculous cures by the hundreds were announced at Lourdes. A new bodhisattva proclaimed herself in Tibet. A novel cargo cult was imported from New Guinea into Australia. It preached the construction of crude radio telescope replicas to attract extraterrestrial largesse. The World Union of Freethinkers called the message a disproof of the existence of God. The Mormon Church declared it a second revelation by the angel Moroni. The message was taken by different groups as evidence for many gods, or one god, or none. Chiliasm was rife. There were those who predicted the millennium in 1999 as a Kabbalistic inversion of 1666, the year that Sabbatai Zevi had adopted for his millennium. Others chose 1996 or 2033, the presumed 2000th anniversaries of the birth or death of Jesus. The great cycle of the ancient Maya was to be completed in the year 2011, when, according to this independent cultural tradition, the cosmos would end. The convolution of the Mayan prediction with Christian millenarianism was producing a kind of apocalyptic frenzy in Mexico and Central America. Some Chiliasts, who believed in the earlier dates, had begun giving away their wealth to the poor, in part because it would soon be worthless anyway, and in part as earnest money to God, a bribe for the advent. Zealotry, fanaticism, fear, hope, fervent debate, quiet prayer, agonizing reappraisal, exemplary selflessness, close-minded bigotry, and a zest for dramatically new ideas were epidemic, rushing feverishly over the surface of the tiny planet Earth. Slowly emerging from this mighty ferment, Ellie thought she could see was a dawning recognition of the world as one thread in a vast cosmic tapestry. Meanwhile, the message itself continued to resist attempts at decryption. On the vilification channels protected by the First Amendment, she, Vega, Derheer, and to a lesser extent Peter Valerian, were being castigated for a variety of offenses, including atheism, communism, and hoarding the message for themselves. In her opinion, Vega wasn't much of a communist, and Valerian had a deep, quiet, but sophisticated Christian faith. If they were lucky enough to come anywhere near cracking the message, she was willing to deliver it personally to this sanctimonious twit of a television commentator. David Drumlin, however, was being made out as the hero, the man who had really decrypted the prime number and Olympic broadcasts. He was the kind of scientist we needed more of. She sighed and changed the channel once again. She had come round to TABS, the Turner American Broadcasting System, the only survivor of the large commercial networks that had dominated television broadcasting in the United States until the advent of widespread direct satellite broadcasting and 180-channel cable. On this station, Palmer Joss was making one of his rare television appearances. Like most Americans, Ellie instantly recognized his resonant voice, his slightly unkempt good looks, and the discoloration beneath his eyes that made you think he never slept for worrying about the rest of us.
"What has science really done for us?" he declaimed. "Are we really happier? I don't mean just holographic receivers and seedless grapes. Are we fundamentally happier? Or do the scientists bribe us with toys, with technological trinkets, while they undermine our faith?"
Here was a man, she thought, who was hankering for a simpler age. A man who has spent his life attempting to reconcile the irreconcilable. He has condemned the most flagrant excesses of pop religion and thinks that justifies attacks on evolution and relativity. Why not attack the existence of the electron? Palmer Joss never saw one, and the Bible is innocent of electromagnetism. Why believe in electrons? Although she had never before listened to him speak, she was sure that sooner or later he would come around to the message. And he did.
"The scientists keep their findings to themselves, give us little bits and pieces, enough to keep us quiet. They think we're too stupid to understand what they do. They give us conclusions without evidence. Findings as if they were holy writ and not speculations, theories, hypotheses. What ordinary people would call guesses. They never ask if some new theory is as good for people as the belief that it tries to replace. They overestimate what they know and underestimate what we know. When we ask for explanations, they tell us it takes years to understand. I know about that. Because in religion also there are things that take years to understand. You can spend a lifetime and never come close to understanding the nature of Almighty God. But you don't see the scientists coming to religious leaders to ask them about their years of study and insight and prayer. They never give us a second thought except when they mislead us and deceive us. And now they say they have a message from the star Vega. But a star can't send a message. Someone is sending it. Who? Is the purpose of the message divine or satanic? When they decode the message, will it end "yours truly God" or "sincerely the devil"? When the scientists get around to telling us what's in the message, will they tell us the whole truth, or will they hold something back because they think we can't understand it, or because it doesn't match what they believe? Aren't these the people who taught us how to annihilate ourselves? I tell you, my friends, science is too important to be left to the scientists. Representatives of the major faiths ought to be part of the process of decoding. We ought to be looking at the raw data. That's what the scientists call it, raw. Otherwise, where will we be? They'll tell us something about the message. Maybe what they really believe, maybe not. And we'll have to accept it, whatever they tell us. There are some things the scientists know about. There are other things, take my word for it, they know nothing about. Maybe they've received a message from another being in the heavens. Maybe not. Can they be sure the message isn't a golden calf? I don't think they'd know one if they saw one. These are the folks who brought us the hydrogen bomb. Forgive me, Lord, for not being more grateful to these kind souls. I have seen God face to face. I worship Him, trust Him, love Him with my entire soul, with all of my being. I don't think anyone could believe more than I do. I can't see how the scientists could believe in science more than I do in God. They're ready to throw away their truths when a new idea comes around. They're proud of it. They don't see any end to knowing. They imagine we're locked in ignorance until the end of time, that there's no certainty anywhere in nature. Newton overthrew Aristotle. Einstein overthrew Newton. Tomorrow someone else will overthrow Einstein. As soon as we get to understand one theory, there's another one in its place. I wouldn't mind so much if they had warned us that the old ideas were tentative.
Newton's law of gravitation, they called it.
They still call it that.
But if it was a law of nature, how could it be wrong?
How could it be overthrown? Only God can repeal the laws of nature, not the scientists. They just got it wrong. If Albert Einstein was right, Isaac Newton was an amateur, a bungler.
Remember, the scientists don't always get it right. They want to take away our faith, our beliefs, and they offer us nothing of spiritual value in return. I do not intend to abandon God because the scientists write a book and say it is a message from Vega. I will not worship science. I will not deny the first commandment. I will not bow down before a golden calf.
End of side 6. Side 7. When he was a very young man, before he became widely known and admired, Palmer Joss had been a carnival roustabout. It was mentioned in his profile in Times Week. It was no secret. To help make his fortune, he had arranged for a map of the Earth in cylindrical projection to be painstakingly tattooed on his torso. He would exhibit himself at county fairs and sideshows from Oklahoma to Mississippi, one of the stragglers and remnants of a more vigorous age of rural, itinerant entertainment. In the expanse of blue ocean were the four gods of the winds, their cheeks puffing forth, prevailing westerlies and nor'easters. By flexing his pectorals, he could make Boreas swell along with the mid-Atlantic. Then he would declaim to the astonished onlookers from Book 6 of Ovid's Metamorphoses. Monarch of violence, rolling on clouds, I toss wide waters, and I fell huge trees, possessed of demon rage I penetrate, sheer to the utmost caverns of old earth, and straining up from those unfathomed deeps, scatter the terror-stricken shades of hell, and hurl death-dealing earthquakes throughout the world. Fire and brimstone from old Rome. With some help from his hands, he would demonstrate continental drift, pressing West Africa against South America, so they joined, like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle,
almost perfectly at the longitude of his navel.
They billed him as Geos, the Earth Man. Joss was a great reader, and being unencumbered by a formal education past grade school, had not been told that science and classics were unseemly fare for ordinary people. Aided by his casual, rumpled good looks, he would ingratiate himself with librarians in the towns along the carnival's trek and ask what serious books he should read. He wanted, he told them, to improve himself. Dutifully he read about winning friends and investing in real estate and intimidating your acquaintances without their noticing, but felt these books somehow shallow. By contrast, in ancient literature and in modern science, he thought he detected quality. When there were layovers, he would haunt the local town or county library. He taught himself some geography and history. They were job-related, he told Elvira, the elephant girl, who questioned him closely on his absences. She suspected him of compulsive dalliances. "A librarian in every port," she once said. But she had to admit, his professional patter was improving. The contents were too highbrow, but the delivery was down home. Surprisingly, Joss's little stall began to make money for the carnival. His back to the audience, he was one day demonstrating the collision of India with Asia and the resulting crinkling up of the Himalayas, when out of a gray but rainless sky, a lightning bolt flashed and struck him dead. There had been twisters in southeastern Oklahoma, and the weather was unusual throughout the South. He had a perfectly lucid sense of leaving his body, pitifully crumpled on the sawdust-covered planking, being regarded with caution and something akin to awe by the small crowd, and rising, rising, as if through a long, dark tunnel,
slowly approaching a brilliant light. And in the radiance, he gradually discerned a figure of heroic, indeed of godlike proportions. When he awoke, he found a part of himself disappointed to be alive. He was lying on a cot in a modestly furnished bedroom. Leaning over him was the Reverend Billy Joe Rankin, not the present incumbent of that name, but his father, a venerable surrogate preacher of the third quarter of the 20th century. In the background, Joss thought he could see a dozen hooded figures singing the Kyrie Eleison. But he couldn't be sure.
"Am I gonna live or die?"
the young man whispered.
"My boy, you're gonna do both,"
the Reverend Mr. Rankin replied. Joss was soon overcome with a poignant sense of discovery at the existence of the world, but in a way that was difficult for him to articulate. This feeling was in conflict with the beatific image that he had beheld, and with the infinite joy that vision portended. He could sense the two feelings in conflict within his breast. In various circumstances, sometimes in mid-sentence, he would become aware of one or the other of these feelings making some claim on speech or action. After a while, he was content to live with both. He really had been dead, they told him afterwards. A doctor had pronounced him dead. But they had prayed over him, they had sung hymns, and they had even tried to revive him by body massage, mainly in the vicinity of Mauritania. They had returned him to life. He had been truly and literally reborn. Since this corresponded so well to his own perception of the experience, he accepted the account, and gladly. While he almost never talked about it, he became convinced of the significance of the event. He had not been struck dead for nothing. He had not been brought back for no reason. Under his patron's tutelage, he began to study Scripture seriously. He was deeply moved by the idea of the resurrection and the doctrine of salvation. He assisted the Reverend Mr. Rankin at first in small ways, eventually filling in for him in the more onerous or more distant preaching assignments. Especially after the younger Billy Joe Rankin left for Odessa, Texas, in answer to a call from God. Soon Joss found a preaching style that was his own, not so much exhortatory as explanatory. In simple language and homely metaphors, he would explain baptism in the afterlife, the connection of Christian revelation with the myths of classical Greece and Rome, the idea of God's plan for the world, and the conformity of science and religion when both were properly understood. This was not the conventional preaching, and it was too ecumenical for many tastes. But it proved unaccountably popular.
"You've been reborn, Joss," the elder Rankin told him. "So you ought to change your name."
"Except Palmer Joss is such a fine name for a preacher, you'd be a fool not to keep it."
Like doctors and lawyers, the vendors of religion rarely criticize one another's wares, Joss observed. But one night he attended services at the New Church of God Crusader to hear the younger Billy Joe Rankin, triumphantly returned from Odessa, preach to the multitude. Billy Joe enunciated a stark doctrine of reward, retribution, and the rapture. But tonight was a healing night. The curative instrument, the congregation was told, was the holiest of relics, holier than a splinter of the true cross, holier even than the thigh bone of Saint Teresa of Avila, that Generalissimo Francisco Franco had kept in his office to intimidate the pious. What Billy Joe Rankin brandished was the actual amniotic fluid that surrounded and protected our Lord. The liquid had been carefully preserved in an ancient earthenware vessel that once belonged, so it was said, to Saint Anne. "The tiniest drop of it would cure what ails you," he promised, "through a special act of divine grace. This holiest of holy waters was with us tonight." Joss was appalled. Not so much that Rankin would attempt so transparent a scam, but that any of the parishioners were so credulous as to accept it. In his previous life, he had witnessed many attempts to bamboozle the public. But that was entertainment. This was different. This was religion. Religion was too important to gloss the truth, much less to manufacture miracles. He took to denouncing this imposture from the pulpit. As his fervor grew, he railed against other deviant forms of Christian fundamentalism, including those aspirant herpetologists who tested their faith by fondling snakes in accord with the biblical injunction that the pure of heart shall not fear the venom of serpents. In one widely quoted sermon, he paraphrased Voltaire. He never thought, he said, that he would find men of the cloth so venal as to lend support to the blasphemers who taught that the first priest was the first rogue who met the first fool. These religions were damaging religion. He shook his finger gracefully in the air. Joss argued that in every religion there was a doctrinal line beyond which it insulted the intelligence of its practitioners. Reasonable people might disagree as to where that line should be drawn, but religions trespassed well beyond it at their peril. People were not fools, he said. The day before his death, as he was putting his affairs in order, the elder Rankin sent word to Joss that he never wanted to lay eyes on him again. At the same time, Joss began to preach that science didn't have all the answers either. He found inconsistencies in the theory of evolution. The embarrassing findings, the facts that don't fit, the scientists just sweep under the rug, he said. They don't really know that the Earth is 4.6 billion years old any more than Archbishop Usher knew that it was 6,000 years old. Nobody has seen evolution happen. Nobody has been marking time since the creation. 200 quadrillion, Mississippi, he once imagined the patient timekeeper intoning, counting up the seconds from the origin of the world. And Einstein's theory of relativity was also unproved. You couldn't travel faster than light, no matter what, Einstein had said. How could he know? How close to the speed of light had he gone? Relativity was only a way of understanding the world. Einstein couldn't restrict what mankind could do in the far future. And Einstein sure couldn't set limits on what God could do. Couldn't God travel faster than light if he wanted to? Couldn't God make us travel faster than light if he wanted to? There were excesses in science, and there were excesses in religion. A reasonable man wouldn't be stampeded by either one. There were many interpretations of Scripture and many interpretations of the natural world. Both were created by God, so both must be mutually consistent. Wherever a discrepancy seems to exist, either a scientist or a theologian, maybe both, hasn't been doing his job. Palmer Joss combined his even-handed criticism of science and religion with a fervent plea for moral rectitude and a respect for the intelligence of his flock. In slow stages, he acquired a national reputation. In debates on the teaching of scientific creationism in the schools, on the ethical status of abortion and frozen embryos, on the admissibility of genetic engineering, he attempted in his way to steer a middle course, to reconcile caricatures of science and religion. Both contending camps were outraged at his interventions, and his popularity grew. He became a confidant of presidents. His sermons were excerpted on the op-ed pages of major secular newspapers. But he resisted many invitations and some proffered blandishments to found an electronic church. He continued to live simply, and rarely, except for presidential invitations and ecumenical congresses, left the rural South. Beyond a conventional patriotism, he made it a rule not to meddle in politics. In a field filled with competing entries, many of dubious probity, Palmer Joss became an erudition and moral authority, the preeminent Christian fundamentalist preacher of his day. Terheer had asked if they could have a quiet dinner somewhere. He was flying in for the summary session with Vege and the Soviet delegation on the latest progress in the interpretation of the message. But South Central New Mexico was crawling with the world's press, and there was no restaurant for 100 miles in which they could talk unobserved and unheard. So she made dinner herself in her modest apartment, near the visiting scientists' quarters at the Argus facility. There was a great deal to talk about. Sometimes it seemed that the fate of the whole project was hanging by a presidential thread. But the little tremor of anticipation she felt just before Ken's arrival was occasioned, she was vaguely aware, by more than that. Joss was not exactly business, so they got around to him while loading the dishwasher. "The man is scared stiff," Ellie said. "His perspective is narrow. He imagines the message is going to be unacceptable biblical exegesis or something that shakes his faith. He has no idea about how a new scientific paradigm subsumes the previous one. He wants to know what science has done for him lately, and he's supposed to be the voice of reason."
"Compared to the doomsday Kiliasts and the Earth Firsters, the Palmer Joss is the soul of moderation," Durheer replied. "Maybe we haven't explained the methods of science as well as we should have. I worry about that a lot these days. And Ellie, can you really be sure that it isn't a message from God or the devil?"
"Ken, you can't be serious."
"Well, how about advanced beings committed to what we might call good or evil, who somebody like Joss would consider indistinguishable from God or the devil?"
"Ken, whoever those beings are in the Vega system, I guarantee they didn't create the universe. And they're nothing like the Old Testament God. Remember, Vega, the sun, and all the other stars in the solar neighborhood are in some backwater of an absolutely humdrum galaxy. Why should I Am That I Am hang out around here? There must be more pressing things for him to do."
"Ellie, we're in a bind. You know Joss is very influential. He's been close to 3 presidents, including the present incumbent. The president is inclined to make some concession to Joss, although I don't think she wants to put him and a bunch of other preachers on the preliminary decryption committee with you, Valerian, and Drumlin, to say nothing of Vega and his colleagues. It's hard to imagine the Russians going along with fundamentalist clergy on the committee.
The whole thing could unravel over this. So why don't we go and talk to him? The president says that Joss is really fascinated by science. Suppose we won him over.
We're going to convert Palmer Joss. I'm not imagining making him change his religion. Let's just make him understand what Argus is about. How we don't have to answer the message if we don't like what it says. How interstellar distances quarantine us from Vega.
Ken, he doesn't even believe that the velocity of light is a cosmic speed limit. We're going to be talking past each other. Also, I've got a long history of failure in accommodating to the conventional religions. I tend to blow my top at their inconsistencies and hypocrisies. I'm not sure a meeting between Joss and me is what you want, or the president.
Ellie, he said, I know who I'd put my money on. I don't see how getting together with Joss could make things much worse.
She allowed herself to return his smile. With the tracking ships now in place, and a few small but adequate radio telescopes installed in such places as Reykjavik and Jakarta, there was now redundant coverage of the signal from Vega at every longitude swath. A major conference was scheduled to be held in Paris of the full World Message Consortium. In preparation, it was natural for the nations with the largest fraction of the data to hold a preparatory scientific discussion. They had been meeting for the better part of 4 days, and this summary session was intended mainly to bring those such as Durheer, who served as intermediaries between the scientists and the politicians, up to speed. The Soviet delegation, while nominally headed by Lunacharsky, included several scientists and technical people of equal distinction. Among them were Genrikh Arkhangelsky, recently named head of the Soviet-led International Space Consortium called Intercosmos, and Timofey Gotritsky, listed as Minister of Medium-Heavy Industry, and a member of the Central Committee. Vege clearly felt himself under unusual pressures. He had resumed chain-smoking. He held the cigarette between his thumb and forefinger, palm up as he talked.
I agree that there is adequate overlap in longitude, but I'm still worried about redundancy. A failure in the helium liquefier on board the Marshall Nedlin, or a power failure in Reykjavik, and the continuity of the message is in jeopardy. Suppose the message takes 2 years to cycle around to the beginning. If we miss a piece, we will have to wait 2 more years to fill in the gap. And remember, we don't know that the message will be repeated. If there's no repeat, the gaps will never be repaired. I think we need to plan even for unlikely possibilities.
What are you thinking of? Durhir asked. Something like emergency generators for every observatory in the consortium?
Yes, and independent amplifiers, spectrometers, autocorrelators, disk drives, and so forth at each observatory, and some provision for fast airlift of liquid helium to remote observatories if necessary.
Ellie, do you agree?
Absolutely.
Anything else?
I think we should continue to observe Vega on a very broad range of frequencies,
Vega said.
Perhaps tomorrow a different message will come through on only one of the message frequencies. We should also monitor other regions of the sky. Maybe the key to the message won't come from Vega, but from somewhere else.
Let me say why I think Vega's point is important, interjected Valerian. This is a unique moment. When we're receiving a message, but have made no progress at all in decrypting it. We have no previous experience along these lines. We have to cover all the bases. We don't want to wind up a year or two from now kicking ourselves because there was some simple precaution we forgot to take or some simple measurement that we overlooked. The idea that the message will cycle back on itself is the merest guess. There's nothing in the message itself, as far as we can see, that promises cycling back. Any opportunities lost now may be lost for all time. I also agree there's more instrumental development that needs doing. For all we know, there's a fourth layer to the palimpsest.
There's also the question of personnel.
Vege continued.
Suppose this message goes on not for a year or two, but for decades. Or suppose this is just the first in a long series of messages from all over the sky. There are at most a few hundred really capable radio astronomers in the world.
That is a very small number when the stakes are so high. The industrialized countries must start producing many more radio astronomers and radio engineers with first-rate training.
Ellie noted that Gotsrita, who had said little, was taking detailed notes. She was again struck by how much more literate the Soviets were in English than the Americans in Russian. Near the beginning of the century, scientists all over the world spoke, or at least read, German. Before that, it had been French, and before that, Latin. In another century, there might be some other obligatory scientific language, Chinese, perhaps. For the moment, it was English, and scientists all over the planet struggled to learn its ambiguities and irregularities. Lighting a fresh cigarette from the glowing tip of its predecessor, Vege went on.
There is something else to be said, though. This is just speculation. It's not even as plausible as the idea that the message will cycle back on itself, which Professor Valerian quite properly stressed was only a guess. I would not ordinarily mention so speculative an idea at such an early stage. But if the speculation is sound, there are certain further actions we must begin thinking about immediately. I would not have the courage to raise this possibility if Academician Arkhangelsky had not come tentatively to the same conclusion.
He and I have disagreed about the quantization of quasar redshifts, the explanation of superluminal light sources, the rest mass of the neutrino, quark physics in neutron stars. We have had many disagreements. I must admit that sometimes he has been right and sometimes I have been right. Almost never, it seems to me, in the early speculative stage of a subject have we agreed, but on this, we agree. Genrikh Dmitrich, would you explain?
Arkhangelsky seemed tolerant. even amused. He and Lunacharsky had been for years engaged in personal rivalry, heated scientific disputes, and a celebrated controversy on the prudent level of support for Soviet fusion research.
"We guess," he said, "that the message is the instructions for building a machine. Of course, we have no knowledge about how to decode the message. The evidence is in internal references. I give you an example. Here on page 15,441 is a clear reference to an earlier page, 13,097, which, by luck, we also have. The later page was received here in New Mexico, the earlier one at our observatory near Tashkent. On page 13,097, there is another reference, this to a time when we were not covering our longitudes. There are many cases of this back referencing. In general, and this is the important point, there are complicated instructions on a recent page, but simpler instructions on an earlier page. In one case, there are 8 citations to earlier material on a single page."
That's not an awfully compelling argument, guys, replied Ellie. Maybe it's a set of mathematical exercises, the later ones building on the earlier ones. Maybe it's a long novel. They might have very long lifetimes compared to us, in which events are connected with childhood experiences, or whatever they have on Vega when they're young. Maybe it's a tightly cross-referenced religious manual.
The 10 billion commandments,
Terhir laughed.
Maybe,
said Lunacharsky, staring through a cloud of cigarette smoke out the window at the telescopes. They seemed to be staring longingly at the sky.
But when you look at the patterns of cross-references, I think you'll agree it looks more like the instruction manual for building a machine.
Ugh, God knows what the machine is supposed to do.
Chapter 9. The Numinous. Wonder is the basis of worship. Thomas Carlyle, Sartor Resartus, 1833-34. I maintain that the cosmic religious feeling is the strongest and noblest motive for scientific research. Albert Einstein, Ideas and Opinions, 1954. She could recall the exact moment when, on one of many trips to Washington, she discovered that she was falling in love with Ken Terhir. Arrangements for the meeting with Farmer Joss seemed to be taking forever. Apparently Joss was reluctant to visit the Argus facility. It was the impiety of the scientists, not their interpretation of the message, he now said, that interested him. And to probe their character, some more neutral ground was needed. Ellie was willing to go anywhere, and a special assistant to the president was negotiating. Other radio astronomers were not to go. The president wanted it to be Ellie alone. Ellie was also waiting for the day, still some weeks off, when she would fly to Paris for the first full meeting of the World Message Consortium. She and Vega were coordinating the Global Data Collection Program. The signal acquisition was now fairly routine, and in recent months there had been not one gap in the coverage. So she found to her surprise that she had a little time on her hands. She vowed to have a long talk with her mother, and to remain civil and friendly, no matter what provocation was offered. There was an absurd amount of backed-up paper and electronic mail to go through, not just congratulations and criticisms from colleagues, but religious admonitions, pseudo-scientific speculations proposed with great confidence, and fan mail from all over the world. She had not read the Astrophysical Journal in months, although she was the first author of a very recent paper that was surely the most extraordinary article that had ever appeared in that august publication. The signal from Vega was so strong that many amateurs, tired of ham radio, had begun constructing their own small radio telescopes and signal analyzers. In the early stages of message acquisition, they had turned up some useful data, and Ellie was still besieged by amateurs who thought they had acquired something unknown to the SETI professionals. She felt an obligation to write encouraging letters. There were other meritorious radio astronomy programs at the facility. The quasar survey, for example, that needed attending to. But instead of doing all these things, she found herself spending almost all her time with Ken. Of course, it was her duty to involve the president's science advisor in Project Argus as deeply as he wished. It was important that the president be fully and competently informed. She hoped the leaders of other nations would be as thoroughly briefed on the findings from Vega as was the president of the United States. This president, while untrained in science, genuinely liked the subject and was willing to support science, not only for its practical benefits, but at least a little for the joy of knowing. This had been true of few previous American leaders since James Madison and John Quincy Adams. Still, it was remarkable how much time Derheer was able to spend at Argus. He did devote an hour or more each day in high-bandpass scrambled communications with his Office of Science and Technology Policy in the old executive office building in Washington. But the rest of the time, as far as she could see, he was simply around. He would poke into the innards of the computer system or visit individual radio telescopes. Sometimes an assistant from Washington would be with him. More often, he would be alone. She would see him through the open door of the spare office they had assigned him, his feet propped up on the desk, reading some report or talking on the phone. He would offer her a cheery wave and return to his work. She would find him talking casually with Drumlin or Valerian, but equally so with junior technicians and with the secretarial staff, who had on more than one occasion pronounced him within Ellie's hearing charming. Derheer had many questions for her as well. At first they were purely technical and programmatic, but soon they extended to plans for a wide variety of conceivable future events, and then to untrammeled speculation. These days it almost seemed that discussion of the project was only a pretext to spend a little time together. One fine autumn afternoon in Washington, the president was obliged to delay a meeting of the Special Contingency Task Group because of the Tyrone Free crisis. After an overnight flight from New Mexico, Ellie and Derheer found themselves with an unscheduled few hours and decided to visit the Vietnam Memorial, designed by Maya Ying Lin when she was still an undergraduate architectural student at Yale. Amidst the somber and doleful reminders of a foolish war, Derheer seemed inappropriately cheerful, and Ellie began again to speculate about flaws in his character. A pair of General Service Administration plainclothes security people, their custom-molded flesh-colored earpieces in place, followed discreetly. He had coaxed an exquisite blue caterpillar to climb aboard a twig. It briskly padded along, its iridescent body rippling with the motion of 14 pairs of feet. At the end of the twig, it held on with its last 5 segments and flailed the air in a plucky attempt to find a new perch. Unsuccessful, it turned itself around smartly and retraced its many steps. Derheer then changed his clutch on the twig so that when the caterpillar returned to its starting point, there was again nowhere to go. Like some caged mammalian carnivore, it paced back and forth many times. But in the last few passages, it seemed to her, with increasing resignation. She was beginning to feel pity for the poor creature, even if it proved to be, say, the larva responsible for the barley blight. "What a wonderful program in this little guy's head," he exclaimed. "It works every time. Optimum escape software. And he knows not to fall off. I mean, the twig is effectively suspended in air. The caterpillar never experiences that in nature because the twig is always connected to something." "Ellie, did you ever wonder what that program would feel like if it was in your head? I mean, would it just seem obvious to you what you had to do when you came to the end of a twig? Would you have the impression you were thinking it through? Would you wonder how you knew to shake your front 10 feet in the air but hold on tight with the other 18? She inclined her head slightly and examined him rather than the caterpillar. He seemed to have little difficulty imagining her as an insect. She tried to reply noncommittally, reminding herself that for him this would be a matter of professional interest. What do you do with it now?
I'll put it back down in the grass, I guess.
What else would you do with it?
Some people might kill it.
It's hard to kill a creature once it lets you see its consciousness.
He continued to carry both twig and larva. They walked for a while in silence, past almost 55,000 names engraved in reflecting black granite. Every government that prepares for war paints its adversaries as monsters, she said. They don't want you thinking of the other side as human. If the enemy can think and feel, you might hesitate to kill them. And killing is very important. Better to see them as monsters.
Yeah, look at this beauty, he replied after a moment. Really, look closely.
She did. Fighting back a small tremor of revulsion, she tried to see it through his eyes.
Watch what it does, he continued.
If it was as big as you or me, it would scare everybody to death. It would be a genuine monster, right? But it's little. It eats leaves, minds its own business, and adds a little beauty to the world.
She took the hand not preoccupied with the caterpillar, and they walked wordlessly past the ranks of names inscribed in chronological order of death. These were, of course, only the American casualties. Except in the hearts of their families and friends. There was no comparable memorial anywhere on the planet for the 2 million people of Southeast Asia who had also died in the conflict. In America, the most common public comment about this war was about political hamstringing of military power, psychologically akin, she thought, to the stab-in-the-back explanation by German militarists of their World War I defeat. The Vietnam War was a pustule on the national conscience that no president so far had the courage to lance. Subsequent policies of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam had not made this task easier. She remembered how common it was for American soldiers to call their Vietnamese adversaries gooks, slopeheads, slant eyes, and worse. Could we possibly manage the next phase of human history without first dealing with this penchant for dehumanizing the adversary? In everyday conversation, Jurheer didn't talk like an academic. If you met him at the corner newsstand buying a paper, you'd never guess he was a scientist. He hadn't lost his New York street accent. At first, the apparent incongruity between his language and the quality of his scientific work seemed amusing to his colleagues. As his research and the man himself became better known, his accent became merely idiosyncratic. But his pronunciation of, say, guanosine triphosphate seemed to give this benign molecule explosive properties. They had been slow in recognizing that they were falling in love. It must have been apparent to many others. A few weeks before, when Lunacharsky was still at Argus, he launched himself on one of his occasional tirades on the irrationality of language. This time, it was the turn of American English.
Ellie, why do people say, make the same mistake again? What does again add to the sentence? And am I right that burn up and burn down mean the same thing? Slow up and slow down mean the same thing? So if screw up is acceptable, why not screw down?
She nodded wearily. She had heard him more than once complain to his Soviet colleagues on the inconsistencies of the Russian language, and was sure she would hear a French edition of all this at the Paris conference. She was happy to admit that languages had infelicities, but they had so many sources and evolved in response to so many small pressures that it would be astonishing if they were perfectly coherent and internally consistent. Vege had such a good time complaining, though, that she ordinarily did not have the heart to remonstrate with him.
"And take this phrase, head over heels in love," he continued. "This is a common expression, yes, but it's exactly backward, or rather upside down. You are ordinarily head over heels. When you are in love, you should be heels over head. Am I right?"
You would know about falling in love. But whoever invented this phrase did not know about love. He imagined you walk around in the usual way, instead of floating upside down in the air like the work of that French painter. What's his name?
He was Russian, she replied. Marc Chagall had provided a narrow pathway out of a somewhat awkward conversational thicket. Afterward, she wondered if Vege had been teasing her or probing for a response. Perhaps he had only unconsciously recognized the growing bond between Ellie and Derhier. At least part of Derhier's reluctance was clear. Here he was, the president's science advisor, devoting an enormous amount of time to an unprecedented, delicate, and volatile matter. To become emotionally involved with one of the principals was risky. The president certainly wanted his judgment unimpaired. He should be able to recommend courses of action that Ellie opposed, and to urge rejection of options that she supported. Falling in love with Ellie would, on some level, compromise Derhier's effectiveness. For Ellie, it was more complicated. Before she had acquired the somewhat staid respectability of the directorship of a major radio observatory, she had had many partners. While she had felt herself in love and declared herself so, marriage had never seriously tempted her. She dimly remembered the quatrain. Was it William Butler Yeats? With which she had tried to reassure her early swains, heartbroken because, as always, she had determined that the affair was over. You say there is no love, my love, unless it lasts for a... Ah, folly, there are episodes far better than the play. She recalled how charming John Stoughton had been to her while courting her mother, and how easily he had cast off this pose after he became her stepfather. Some new and monstrous persona, hitherto barely glimpsed, could emerge in men shortly after you married them. Her romantic predispositions made her vulnerable, she thought. She was not going to repeat her mother's mistake. A little deeper was a fear of falling in love without reservation, of committing herself to someone who might then be snatched from her, or simply leave her. But if you never really fall in love, you can never really miss it. She did not dwell on this sentiment, dimly aware that it did not ring quite true. Also, if she never really fell in love with someone, she could never really betray him, as in her heart of hearts she felt that her mother had betrayed her long-dead father. She still missed him terribly. With Ken, it seemed to be different, or had her expectations been gradually compromised over the years. Unlike many other men she could think of, when challenged or stressed, Ken displayed a gentler, more compassionate side. His tendency to compromise and his skill in scientific politics were part of the accoutrements of his job. But underneath, she felt she had glimpsed something solid. She respected him for the way he had integrated science into the whole of his life, and for the courageous support for science that he had tried to inculcate into two administrations. They had, as discreetly as possible, been staying together, more or less, in her small apartment at Argus. Their conversations were a joy, with ideas flying back and forth like shuttlecocks. Sometimes, they responded to each other's uncompleted thoughts with almost perfect foreknowledge. He was a considerate and inventive lover, and anyway, she liked his pheromones. She was sometimes amazed at what she was able to do and say in his presence because of their love. She came to admire him so much that his love for her affected her own self-esteem. She liked herself better because of him. And since he clearly felt the same, there was a kind of infinite regress of love and respect underlying their relationship. At least, that was how she described it to herself. In the presence of so many of her friends, she had felt an undercurrent of loneliness. With Ken, it was gone. She was comfortable describing to him her reveries, snatches of memories, childhood embarrassments. and he was not merely interested but fascinated. He would question her for hours about her childhood. His questions were always direct, sometimes probing, but without exception, gentle. She began to understand why lovers talk baby talk to one another. There was no other socially acceptable circumstance in which the children inside her were permitted to come out. If the 1-year-old, the 5-year-old, the 12-year-old, and the 20-year-old all find compatible personalities in the beloved, there is a real chance to keep all of these sub-personas happy. Love ends their long loneliness. Perhaps the depth of love can be calibrated by the number of different selves that are actively involved in a given relationship. With her previous partners, it seemed, at most one of these selves was able to find a compatible opposite number. The other personas were grumpy hangers-on. End of Side 7.
Side 8. The weekend before the scheduled meeting with Joss, they were lying in bed as the late afternoon sunlight, admitted between the slats of the Venetian blinds, played patterns on their intertwined forms. "In ordinary conversation," she was saying, "I can talk about my father without feeling more than a slight pang of loss. But if I allow myself to really remember him, his sense of humor, say, or that passionate fairness, then the facade crumbles and I want to weep because he's gone."
"No question. Language can free us of feeling. Or almost,"
Durhir replied, stroking her shoulder.
"Maybe that's one of its functions, so we can understand the world without becoming entirely overwhelmed by it."
"If so, then the invention of language isn't only a blessing. You know, Ken, I'd give anything. I really mean anything I have if I could just spend a few minutes with my dad." She imagined a heaven with all those nice moms and dads floating about or flapping over to a nearby cloud. It would have to be a commodious place to accommodate all the tens of billions of people who had lived and died since the emergence of the human species. It might be very crowded, she was thinking, unless the religious heaven was built on a scale something like the astronomical heaven. Then there'd be room to spare.
"There must be some number," Ellie said, "that measures the total population of intelligent beings in the Milky Way. How many do you suppose it is? If there's 1 million civilizations, each with about 1 billion individuals, that's 10^15 power intelligent beings. But if most of them are more advanced than we are, maybe the idea of individuals becomes inappropriate. Maybe that's just another Earth chauvinism."
"Sure. And then you can calculate the galactic production rate of Gaulois and Twinkies and Volga sedans and Sony pocket communicators. Then we could calculate the gross galactic product. Once we have that in hand, we could work on the gross cosmic."
"You're making fun of me," she said with a soft smile, not at all displeased.
"But think about such numbers. I mean, really think about them. All those planets with all those beings more advanced than we are. Don't you get a kind of tingle thinking about it?" She could tell what he was thinking, but rushed on. "Here, look at this. I've been reading up for the meeting with Joss."
She reached toward the bedside table for volume 16 of an old Encyclopedia Britannica Macropedia titled Rubens to Somalia, and opened to a page where a scrap of computer printout had been inserted as a bookmark. She pointed to an article called Sacred or Holy. "The theologians seem to have recognized a special non-rational, I wouldn't call it irrational, aspect of the feeling of sacred or holy. They call it numinous. The term was first used by, somebody named Rudolf Otto in a 1923 book, The Idea of the Holy. He believed that humans were predisposed to detect and revere the numinous. He called it the mysterium tremendum."
"Even my Latin is good enough for that."
"In the presence of the mysterium tremendum,
people feel utterly insignificant. But, if I read this right, not personally alienated. He thought of the numinous as a thing wholly other, and the human response to it as absolute astonishment. Now, if that's what religious people talk about when they use words like sacred or holy, I'm with them. I felt something like that just in listening for a signal, never mind in actually receiving it. I think all of science elicits that sense of awe. Now listen to this, she read from the text. Throughout the past 100 years, a number of philosophers and social scientists have asserted the disappearance of the sacred and predicted the demise of religion. A study of the history of religions shows that religious forms change and that there has never been unanimity on the nature and expression of religion. Whether or not man... Sexists write and edit religious articles too, of course. She returned to the text. Whether or not man is now in a new situation for developing structures of ultimate values radically different from those provided in the traditionally affirmed awareness of the sacred is a vital question. So? So? I think the bureaucratic religions try to institutionalize your perception of the numinous instead of providing the means so you can perceive the numinous directly. Like looking through a 6-inch telescope. If sensing the numinous is at the heart of religion, who's more religious, would you say? The people who follow the bureaucratic religions? Or the people who teach themselves science? Let's see if I've got this straight, he returned. It was a phrase of hers that he had adopted. It's a lazy Saturday afternoon, and there's this couple lying naked in bed, reading the Encyclopedia Britannica to each other and arguing about whether the Andromeda Galaxy is more numinous than the resurrection. Whew! Do they know how to have a good time, or don't they?
Part 2. The Machine. The Almighty Lecturer, by displaying the principles of science and the structure of the universe, has invited man to study and to imitation. It is as if he had said to the inhabitants of this globe that we call ours, I have made an earth for man to dwell upon, and I have rendered the starry heavens visible to teach him science and the arts. He can now provide for his own comfort, and learn from my munificence to all, to be kind to each other. Thomas Paine, The Age of Reason, 1794. Chapter 10, Precession of the Equinoxes. Do we, holding that the gods exist, deceive ourselves with insubstantial dreams and lies, while random careless chance and change alone control the world? Euripides, Hecuba. It was odd the way it had worked out. She had imagined that Palmer Joss would come to the Argus facility, watch the signal being gathered in by the radio telescopes, and take note of the huge room full of magnetic tapes and disks on which the previous many months of data were stored. He would ask a few scientific questions, and then examine in its multiplicity of zeros and ones some of the reams of computer printout displaying the still incomprehensible message. She hadn't imagined spending hours arguing philosophy or theology. But Joss had refused to come to Argus. It wasn't magnetic tape he wanted to scrutinize, he said. It was human character. Peter Valerian would have been ideal for this discussion, unpretentious, able to communicate clearly, and bulwarked by a genuine Christian faith that engaged him daily. But the president had apparently vetoed the idea. She had wanted a small meeting and had explicitly asked that Ellie attend. Joss had insisted that the discussion be held here at the Bible Science Research Institute and Museum in Modesto, California. She glanced past her here and out the glass partition that separated the library from the exhibit area. Just outside was a plaster impression from a Red River sandstone of dinosaur footprints, interspersed with those of a pedestrian in sandals, proving, so the caption said, that man and dinosaur were contemporaries, at least in Texas.
Mesozoic shoemakers seemed also to be implied. The conclusion drawn in the caption was that evolution was a fraud. The opinion of many paleontologists that the sandstone was the fraud remained, Ellie had noted, 2 hours earlier, unmentioned. The intermingled footprints were part of a vast exhibit called Darwin's Default. To its left was a Foucault pendulum demonstrating the scientific assertion, this one apparently uncontested, that the earth turns. To its right, Ellie could see part of a lavish Matsushita holography unit on the podium of a small theater, from which three-dimensional images of the most eminent divines could communicate directly to the faithful. Communicating still more directly to her at this moment was the Reverend Billy Joe Rankin. She had not known until the last moment that Joss had invited Rankin, and she was surprised at the news. There had been continuing theological disputation between them on whether an advent was at hand, whether doomsday is a necessary accompaniment of the advent, and on the role of miracles in the ministry, among other matters. But they had recently effected a widely publicized reconciliation, done, it was said, for the common good of the fundamentalist community in America. The signs of rapprochement between the United States and the Soviet Union were having worldwide ramifications in the arbitration of disputes. Holding the meeting here was perhaps part of the price Palmer Joss had to pay for the reconciliation. Conceivably, Rankin felt the exhibits would provide factual support for his position, were there any scientific points in dispute. Now, 2 hours into their discussion, Rankin was alternately castigating and imploring. His suit was immaculately tailored, his nails freshly manicured, and his beaming smile stood in some contrast to Joss's rumpled, distracted, and more weather-beaten appearance. Joss, the faintest of smiles on his face, had his eyes half-closed, and his head bowed in what seemed very close to an attitude of prayer. He had not had to say much. Rankin's remarks so far, except for the rapture rap, she guessed, were doctrinally indistinguishable from Joss's television address. "You scientists are so shy," Rankin was saying. "You love to hide your light under a bushel basket. You'd never guess what's in those articles from the titles. Einstein's first work on the theory of relativity was called The Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. No E equals MC squared up front. No, sir. The Electrodynamics of Moving Bodies. I suppose if God appeared to a whole gaggle of scientists, maybe at one of those big association meetings, they'd write something all about it and call it maybe On Spontaneous Dendritiform Combustion in Air. They'd have lots of equations. They'd talk about economy of hypothesis, but they'd never say a word about God. You see, you scientists are too skeptical." From the sidewise motion of his head, Ellie deduced that Jurheer was also included in this assessment. "You question everything, or try to. You never heard about leave well enough alone, or if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You always want to check out if a thing is what you call true. And true means only empirical sense data, things you can see and touch. There's no room for inspiration or revelation in your world. Right from the beginning, you rule out of court almost everything religion is about. I mistrust the scientists because the scientists mistrust everything." Despite herself, she thought Rankin had put his case well. And he was supposed to be the dumb one among the modern video evangelists. No, not dumb, she corrected herself. He was the one who considered his parishioners dumb. He could, for all she knew, be very smart indeed. Should she respond at all? Both Jurheer and the local museum people were recording the discussion. And although both groups had agreed that the recordings were not for public use, she worried about embarrassing the project or the president if she spoke her mind. But Rankin's remarks had become increasingly outrageous, and no interventions were being made either by Jurheer or by Joss. "I suppose you want to reply," she found herself saying. There isn't an official scientific position on any of these questions, and I can't pretend to talk for all scientists, or even for the Argus Project. But I can make some comments, if you'd like. Rankin nodded his head vigorously, smiling encouragement. Languidly, Joss merely waited. I want you to understand that I'm not attacking anybody's belief system. As far as I'm concerned, you're entitled to any doctrine you like, even if it's demonstrably wrong. And many of the things you're saying, and that the Reverend Joss has said, I saw your talk on television a few weeks ago, can't be dismissed instantly. It takes a little work. But let me try to explain why I think they're improbable. So far, she thought, I've been the soul of restraint. You're uncomfortable with scientific skepticism. But the reason it developed is that the world is complicated. It's subtle. Everybody's first idea isn't necessarily right. Also, people are capable of self-deception. Scientists, too. All sorts of socially abhorrent doctrines have at one time or another been supported by scientists, well-known scientists, famous brand-name scientists, and, of course, politicians, and respected religious leaders. Slavery, for instance, or the Nazi brand of racism. Scientists make mistakes. Theologians make mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes. It's part of being human. You say it yourselves. To err is. So the way you avoid the mistakes, or at least reduce the chance that you'll make one, is to be skeptical. You test the ideas. You check them out by rigorous standards of evidence. I don't think there is such a thing as a received truth. But when you let the different opinions debate, when any skeptic can perform his or her own experiment to check some contention out, then the truth tends to emerge. That's the experience of the whole history of science. It isn't a perfect approach, but it's the only one that seems to work. Now, when I look at religion, I see lots of contending opinions. For example, the Christians think the universe is a finite number of years old. From the exhibits out there, it's clear that some Christians and Jews and Muslims think that the universe is only 6,000 years old. The Hindus, on the other hand, and there are lots of Hindus in the world, think that the universe is infinitely old, with an infinite number of subsidiary creations and destructions along the way. Now, they can't both be right. Either the universe is a certain number of years old, or it's infinitely old. Your friends out there, she gestured out the glass door toward several museum workers ambling past Darwin's Default, ought to debate Hindus. God seems to have told them something different from what he told you. But you tend to talk only to yourselves. Maybe a little too strong, she asked herself. The major religions on the earth contradict each other left and right. You can't all be correct. And what if all of you are wrong? That's a possibility, you know. You must care about the truth, right? Well, the way to winnow through all the differing contentions is to be skeptical. I'm not any more skeptical about your religious beliefs than I am about every new scientific idea I hear about. But in my line of work, they're called hypotheses, not inspiration. And not revelation. Joss now stirred a little, but it was Rankin who replied.
The revelations, the confirmed predictions by God in the Old Testament and the New are legion. The coming of the Savior is foretold in Isaiah 53, in Zechariah 14, in 1 Chronicles 17. That he would be born in Bethlehem was prophesied in Micah 5. That he would come from the line of David was foretold in Matthew 1 and in Luke. But that ought to be an embarrassment for you, not a fulfilled prophecy. Matthew and Luke give Jesus totally different genealogies. Worse than that, they trace the lineage from David to Joseph, not from David to Mary. Or don't you believe in God the Father?
Rankin continued smoothly on. Perhaps he hadn't understood her.
The ministry and suffering of Jesus are foretold in Isaiah 52 and 53 in the 22nd Psalm. That he would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver is explicit in Zechariah 11. If you're honest, you can't ignore the evidence of fulfilled prophecy.
and the Bible speaks to our own time. Israel and the Arabs, Gog and Magog, America and Russia, nuclear war, it's all there in the Bible. Anybody with an ounce of sense can see it. You don't have to be some fancy college professor.
Your trouble, she replied, is a failure of the imagination. These prophecies are, almost every one of them, vague, ambiguous, imprecise, open to fraud. They admit lots of possible interpretations. Even the straightforward prophecies, direct from the top, you try to weasel out of. Like Jesus' promise that the kingdom of God would come in the lifetime of some people in his audience. And don't tell me the kingdom of God is within me. His audience understood him quite literally. You only quote the passages that seem to you fulfilled, and ignore the rest. And don't forget there was a hunger to see prophecy fulfilled. But imagine that your kind of God, omnipotent, omniscient, compassionate, really wanted to leave a record for future generations. To make his existence unmistakable, to say, the remote descendants of Moses. It's easy. Trivial. Just a few enigmatic phrases, and some fierce commandment that they be passed on unchanged. Joss leaned forward almost imperceptibly. Such as, the sun is a star, or Mars is a rusty place with deserts and volcanoes like Sinai, or a body in motion tends to remain in motion, or, she quickly scribbled some numbers on a pad. The earth weighs a million, 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 million times as much as a child. Or, I recognize that both of you seem to have some trouble with special relativity, but it's confirmed every day, routinely, in particle accelerators and cosmic rays. How about, there are no privileged frames of reference? Or even, thou shalt not travel faster than light? Anything they couldn't possibly have known 3,000 years ago. Any others? Joss asked. Well, there's an indefinite number of them. Or at least one for every principle of physics. Let's see, heat and light hide in the smallest pebble. Or even, the way of the earth is as two, but the way of the lodestone is as three. I'm trying to suggest that the gravitational force follows an inverse square law, while the magnetic dipole force follows an inverse cube law. Or, in biology, she nodded toward Derheer, who seemed to have taken a vow of silence, how about two strands entwined is the secret of life?
Now that's an interesting one, said Joss. You're talking, of course, about DNA. But you know the physician's staff, the symbol of medicine? Army doctors wear it on their lapels. It's called the caduceus. Shows two serpents intertwined. It's a perfect double helix. From ancient times, that's been the symbol of preserving life. Isn't this exactly the kind of connection you're suggesting?
Well, I thought it's a spiral, not a helix. But if there are enough symbols and enough prophecies and enough myth and folklore, eventually a few of them are going to fit some current scientific understanding, purely by accident. But I can't be sure. Maybe you're right. Maybe the caduceus is a message from God. Of course, it's not a Christian symbol, or a symbol of any of the major religions today. I don't suppose you'd want to argue that the gods talked only to the ancient Greeks. What I'm saying is, if God wanted to send us a message, and ancient writings were the only way he could think of doing it, he could have done a better job. And he hardly had to confine himself to writings. Why isn't there a monster crucifix orbiting the earth? Why isn't the surface of the moon covered with the Ten Commandments? Why should God be so clear in the Bible and so obscure in the world? Joss had apparently been ready to reply a few sentences back, a look of genuine pleasure unexpectedly on his face. But Ellie's rush of words was gathering momentum, and perhaps he felt it impolite to interrupt. Also, why would you think that God has abandoned us? He used to chat with patriarchs and prophets every second Tuesday, you believe. He's omnipotent, you say, and omniscient. so it's no particular effort for him to remind us directly, unambiguously of his wishes, at least a few times in every generation. So how come, fellas? Why don't we see him with crystal clarity?
We do!
Rankin put enormous feeling in this phrase.
He is all around us. Our prayers are answered. Tens of millions of people in this country have been born again and have witnessed God's glorious grace. The Bible speaks to us as clearly in this day as it did in the time of Moses and Jesus. Oh, come off it, you know what I mean. Where are the burning bushes? The pillars of fire, the great voice that says, I am that I am, booming down at us out of the sky.
Why should God manifest himself in such subtle and debatable ways when he can make his presence completely unambiguous?
But a voice from the sky is just what you say you found.
Joss made this comment casually, while Ellie paused for breath. He held her eyes with his own.
Rankin quickly picked up the thought.
Absolutely. Just what I was going to say. Abraham and Moses, they didn't have radios or telescopes. They couldn't have heard the Almighty talking on FM.
Maybe today God talks to us in new ways and permits us to have a new understanding. Or maybe it's not God.
Yes, Satan, I've heard some talk about that. It sounds crazy. Let's leave that one alone for a moment, if it's okay with you. You think maybe the message is the voice of God? Your God. Where in your religion does God answer a prayer by repeating the prayer back?
I wouldn't call a Nazi newsreel a prayer myself, Joss said. You say it's to attract our attention.
Then why do you think God has chosen to talk to scientists? Why not preachers like yourself?
Oh, God talks to me all the time.
Rankin's index finger audibly thumped his sternum.
And the Reverend Joss here. God has told me that a revelation is at hand. When the end of the world is nigh, the rapture will be upon us, the judgment of sinners, the ascension to heaven of the elect.
Did he tell you he was going to make that announcement in the radio spectrum? Is your conversation with God recorded somewhere so we can verify that it really happened? Or do we have only your say-so? Why would God choose to announce it to radio astronomers and not to men and women of the cloth? Don't you think it's a little strange that the first message from God in 2,000 years or more is prime numbers? And Adolf Hitler at the 1936 Olympics? Your God must have quite a sense of humor.
My God can have any sense he wants to have.
Durheer was clearly alarmed at the first appearance of real rancor.
Maybe I could remind us all about what we hope to accomplish at this meeting, he began.
Here's Ken in his mollifying mode, Ellie thought. On some issues he's courageous, but chiefly when he has no responsibility for action. He's a brave talker, in private. But on scientific politics, and especially when representing the president, he becomes very accommodating, ready to compromise with the devil himself. She caught herself. The theological language was getting to her.
Oh, that's another thing.
She interrupted her own train of thought as well as Derheer's. If that signal is from God, why does it come from just one place in the sky, in the vicinity of a particularly bright nearby star? Why doesn't it come from all over the sky at once, like the cosmic black-body background radiation? Coming from one star, it looks like a signal from another civilization. Coming from everywhere, it would look much more like a signal from your God.
God can make a signal come from the bunghole of the little bear if he wants.
Rankin's face was becoming bright red.
Excuse me, but you've gotten me riled up. God can do anything.
Anything you don't understand, Mr. Rankin, you attribute to God. God for you is where you sweep away all the mysteries of the world, all the challenges to our intelligence. You simply turn your mind off and say God did it.
Ma'am, I didn't come here to be insulted.
Come here. I thought this was where you lived.
Ma'am!
Rankin was about to say something, but then thought better of it. He took a deep breath and continued.
This is a Christian country, and Christians have true knowledge on this issue, a sacred responsibility to make sure that God's sacred word is understood.
I'm a Christian, and you don't speak for me.
You've trapped yourself in some sort of 5th century religious mania.
Since then, the Renaissance has happened. The Enlightenment has happened. Where have you been?
Both Joss and Urhier were half out of their chairs.
Please, Ken implored, looking directly at Ellie. If we don't keep more to the agenda, I don't see how we can accomplish what the President asked us to.
Well, you wanted a frank exchange of views.
It's nearly noon, Joss observed. Why don't we take a little break for lunch?
Outside the library conference room, leaning on the railing surrounding the Foucault pendulum, Ellie began a brief whispered exchange with Drahir.
I'd like to punch out that cocksure know-it-all holier-than-thou, which...
Why exactly, Ellie?
Aren't ignorance and error painful enough?
Yes, if he'd shut up. But he's corrupting millions.
Sweetheart, he thinks the same about you. When she and Drahir came back from lunch, Ellie noticed immediately that Rankin appeared subdued, while Joss, who was first to speak, seemed cheerful, certainly beyond the requirements of mere cordiality.
Dr. Arroway, he began, I can understand that you're impatient to show us your findings, and that you didn't come here for theological disputation. But please bear with us just a bit longer. You have a sharp tongue. I can't recall the last time Brother Rankin here got so stirred up on matters of the faith. It must be years.
He glanced momentarily at his colleague, who was doodling apparently idly on a yellow legal pad, his collar unbuttoned and his necktie loosened.
I was struck by one or two things you said this morning. You called yourself a Christian. May I ask, in what sense are you a Christian?
You know, this wasn't in the job description when I accepted the directorship of the Argus Project. She said this lightly. I'm a Christian in the sense that I find Jesus Christ to be an admirable historical figure. I think the Sermon on the Mount is one of the greatest ethical statements and one of the best speeches in history. I think that love your enemy might even be the long-shot solution to the problem of nuclear war. I wish he was alive today. It would benefit everybody on the planet. But I think Jesus was only a man. A great man, a brave man, a man with insight into unpopular truths, but I don't think he was God or the Son of God or the grand-nephew of God.
You don't want to believe in God.
Joss said it as a simple statement.
You figure you can be a Christian and not believe in God. Well, let me ask you straight out. Do you believe in God?
The question has a peculiar structure. If I say no, do I mean I'm convinced God doesn't exist, or do I mean I'm not convinced he does exist? Those are two very different statements.
Let's see if they are so different, Dr. Arroway. Oh, may I call you doctor? You believe in Occam's razor, isn't that right? If you have two different, equally good explanations of the same experience, you pick the simplest.
The whole history of science supports it, you say.
Now, if you have serious doubts about whether there is a God, enough doubts so you're unwilling to commit yourself to the faith, then you must be able to imagine a world without God. A world that comes into being without God. A world that goes about its everyday life without God. A world where people die without God. No punishment. No reward. All the saints and prophets, all the faithful who have ever lived. Why, you'd have to believe they were foolish. Deceived themselves, you'd probably say. That would be a world in which we weren't here on earth for any good reason. I mean, for any purpose. It would all be just complicated collisions of atoms. Is that right? Including the atoms that are inside human beings? To me, that would be a hateful and inhuman world. I wouldn't want to live in it. But if you can imagine that world, why straddle? Why occupy some middle ground? If you believe all that already, isn't it much simpler to say, there's no God? You're not being true to Occam's razor.
I think you're waffling.
How can a thoroughgoing, conscientious scientist be an agnostic? If you could even imagine a world without God, wouldn't you just have to be an atheist?
I thought you were going to argue that God is the simpler hypothesis, Ellie said. But this is a much better point. If it were only a matter of scientific discussion, I'd agree with you, Reverend Joss. Science is essentially concerned with examining and correcting hypotheses. If the laws of nature explain all the available facts without supernatural intervention, or even do only as well as the God hypothesis, then for the time being I'd call myself an atheist. Then if a single piece of evidence was discovered that doesn't fit, I'd back off from atheism. We're fully able to detect some breakdown in the laws of nature. The reason I don't call myself an atheist is because this isn't mainly a scientific issue. It's a religious issue and a political issue. The tentative nature of scientific hypothesis doesn't extend into these fields. You don't talk about God as a hypothesis. You think you've cornered the truth. So I point out that you may have missed a thing or two. But if you ask, I'm happy to tell you, I can't be sure I'm right. I've always thought an agnostic is an atheist without the courage of his convictions. You could just as well say that an agnostic is a deeply religious person with at least a rudimentary knowledge of human fallibility. When I say I'm an agnostic, I only mean that the evidence isn't in. There isn't compelling evidence that God exists, at least your kind of God. And there isn't compelling evidence that he doesn't, since more than half the people on the earth aren't Jews or Christians or Muslims. I'd say that there aren't any compelling arguments for your kind of God. Otherwise everybody on earth would have been converted. I say again, if your God wanted to convince us, he could have done a much better job. Look at how clearly authentic the message is. It's being picked up all over the world. Radio telescopes are humming away in countries with different histories, different languages, different politics, different religions. Everybody's getting the same kind of data from the same place in the sky, at the same frequencies with the same polarization modulation. The Muslims, the Hindus, the Christians, and the atheists are all getting the same message. Any skeptic can hook up a radio telescope. It doesn't have to be very big. And get the identical data.
You're not suggesting that your radio message is from God, Rankin offered.
Not at all. Just that the civilization on Vega, with powers infinitely less than what you attribute to your God, was able to make things very clear. If your God wanted to talk to us through the unlikely means of word-of-mouth transmission and ancient writings over thousands of years, he could have done it so there was no room left for debate about his existence. She paused, but neither Joss nor Rankin spoke, so she tried again to steer the conversation to the data. Why don't we just withhold judgment for a while until we make some more progress on decrypting the message? Would you like to see some of the data? This time they assented. Readily enough, it seemed. But she could produce only reams of zeros and ones. Neither edifying nor inspirational. She carefully explained about the presumed pagination of the message and the hoped-for primer. By unspoken agreement, she and Durheer said nothing about the Soviet view that the message was the blueprint for a machine. It was at best a guess and had not yet been publicly discussed by the Soviets. As an afterthought, she described something about Vega itself, its mass, surface temperature, color, distance from the Earth, lifetime, and the ring of orbiting debris around it that had been discovered by the infrared astronomy satellite in 1983. But beyond its being one of the brightest stars in the sky, is there anything special about it? Joss wanted to know. Or anything that connects it up with the Earth? Well, in terms of stellar properties, anything like that, I can't think of a thing. But there is one incidental fact. Vega was the pole star about 12,000 years ago, and it will be again about 14,000 years from now.
I thought the pole star was the pole star.
Rankin, still doodling, said this to the pad of paper. It is. For a few thousand years, but not forever. The Earth is like a spinning top. Its axis is slowly precessing in a circle. She demonstrated, using her pencil as the Earth's axis. It's called the precession
of the equinoxes. Discovered by Hipparchus of Rhodes, added Joth. 2nd century B.C. This seemed a surprising piece of information for him to have at his fingertips.
Exactly.
So, right now, she continued, an arrow from the center of the Earth to the North Pole points to the star we call Polaris, in the constellation of the Little Dipper, or the Little Bear. I believe you were referring to this constellation just before lunch, Mr. Rankin. As the Earth's axis slowly precesses, it points in some different direction in the sky, not toward Polaris, and over 26,000 years the place in the sky to which the North Pole points makes a complete circle. The North Pole points right now very near Polaris, close enough to be useful in navigation. 12,000 years ago, by accident, it pointed to Vega. But there's no physical connection. How the stars are distributed in the Milky Way has nothing to do with the Earth's axis of rotation being tipped 23.5 degrees. Now, 12,000 years ago is 10,000 B.C., the time when civilization was just starting up, isn't that right? Joss asked. Unless you believe that the Earth was created in 4004 B.C. Now, we don't believe that, do we, Brother Rankin? We just don't think the age of the Earth is known with the same precision that you scientists do. On the question of the age of the Earth, we're what you might call agnostics. He had a most attractive smile. So if folks were navigating 10,000 years ago, sailing the Mediterranean, say, or the Persian Gulf, Vega would have been their guide? Oh, that's still in the last ice age. Probably a little early for navigation. But the hunters who crossed the Bering Land Bridge to North America were around then. It must have seemed an amazing gift. Providential, if you like, that such a bright star was exactly to the north. I'll bet a lot of people owed their lives to that coincidence. Well, now that's mighty interesting. I don't want you to think I used the word providential as anything but a metaphor.
I'd never think that, my dear.
Joss was by now giving signs that the afternoon was drawing to a close, and he did not seem displeased. But there were still a few items, it seemed, on Rankin's agenda. It amazes me that you don't think it was divine providence, Vega being the pole star. My faith is so strong, I don't need proofs. But every time a new fact comes along, it simply confirms my faith. Well then, I guess you weren't listening very closely to what I was saying this morning. I resent the idea that we're in some kind of faith contest, and you're the hands-down winner. So far as I know, you've never tested your faith. Are you willing to put your life on the line for your faith? I'm willing to do it for mine. Here, take a look out that window. There's a big Foucault pendulum out there. The bob must weigh 500 pounds. My faith says that the amplitude of a free pendulum, how far it'll swing away from the vertical position, can never increase. It can only decrease. I'm willing to go out there, put the bob in front of my nose, let go, have it swing away, and then back toward me. If my beliefs are in error, I'll get a 500-pound pendulum smack in the face. Come on. You want to test my faith?
Truly, it's not necessary.
I believe you, replied Joss. Rankin, though, seemed interested. He was imagining, she guessed, what she would look like afterward. But would you be willing, she went on, to stand a foot closer to this same pendulum and pray to God to shorten the swing? What if it turns out that you've gotten it all wrong? That what you're teaching isn't God's will at all? Maybe it's the work of the devil. Maybe it's pure human invention. How can you be really sure? Faith, inspiration, revelation, awe, Rankin answered. Don't judge everyone else by your own limited experience. Just the fact that you've rejected the Lord doesn't prevent other folks from acknowledging His glory. Look, we all have a thirst for wonder. It's a deeply human quality. Science and religion are both bound up with it. What I'm saying is you don't have to make stories up, you don't have to exaggerate. There's wonder and awe enough in the real world. Nature's a lot better at inventing wonders than we are.
Perhaps we are all wayfarers on the road to truth, Joss replied.
On this hopeful note, Jurheer stepped in deftly, and amid strained civilities they prepared to leave. She wondered whether anything useful had been accomplished. Valerian would have been much more effective and much less provocative, Ellie thought. She wished she had kept herself in better check.
It's been a most interesting day, Dr. Arroway, and I thank you for it.
Joss seemed a little remote again, courtly but distracted. He shook her hand warmly, though. On the way out to the waiting government car, past the lavishly rendered three-dimensional exhibit on the fallacy of the expanding universe, a sign read, "Our God is alive and well. Sorry about yours." She whispered to Jurheer,
"I'm sorry if I made your job more difficult."
"Oh, no, Ellie. You were fine." "That Palmer Joss is a very attractive man. I don't think I did much to convert him. But I'll tell you, he almost converted me." She was joking, of course.
End of Side 8.